Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating, letting people know about the podcast. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about toxic semen in mosquitoes. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us, we're at Newstalk Science. Before we get into the news round, just to let you know that I was talking a lot last year about the Get Started with AI workshops that I do for businesses trying to harness the power of AI. We have a bootcamp coming up on the 11th of March in Dublin. If you're interested in learning how to use AI to cut hours out of your working week and make things just that much more manageable and get rid of the to-do list, information is at getstartedai.com. All right, we're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. Lara Dungan to go through the week's science news. And it's been a long time, Lara. It's great to have you back. Our first story has to do with a kidney and a very special type of kidney.
It absolutely does. And it is so lovely to be back. I think it's about 6 months since I actually spoke to you guys last. So this is a really interesting story. And it comes from the United States, where the FDA, or the Food and Drug Administration, have approved a clinical trial for 6 patients who are yet unidentified to receive kidneys from, pigs. So it's not the first time that a pig kidney is going to be put in. There are about 5 or 6 instances of pig organs being surgically implanted into human beings. Everyone has died except for one lady, who is a woman from Alabama named Tawana Looney. And she received a pig kidney at the end of last year. And it is still going, and she is still going very strong. And it's really interesting what they've done. So they take these pigs and they genetically modify them. They remove 4 of the pig's genes and they add in 6 human genes. So there's 10 gene edits in the kidney that Tawana has. We don't know exactly what kidneys the 6 people on the trial are going to get. And then they implant these kidneys. And what they do with any kidney transplant isn't quite the same as what you'd picture with a heart transplant. You don't have to take out the person's kidney. You just leave the kidneys where they are and you pop a kidney into their tummy. So right down kind of where you'd imagine your appendix would be is usually where your kidney goes, your new kidney. And this is incredibly exciting because if we take Ireland as an example, actually, as a clinical immunologist, one of our big jobs is kidney transplant. And we have to help make a decision on who does and doesn't get a transplant based on whether someone is a suitable candidate. And some people, for various reasons, so for instance, previous pregnancies, previous transplants, previous blood transfusions, they would have a lot of antibodies against a lot of different kidneys that would be in the population. And these people can basically get no kidneys. And there are people who are on dialysis for years waiting for kidneys. In Ireland, we manage to transplant about 200 kidneys a year. We need about 400 to 500. So a lot of people don't get what they need and they stay in dialysis. So if they can receive these pig kidneys that can be, I suppose, mass manufactured, it would be incredibly exciting. Now, I don't think that this is going to be the mainstream of kidney transplantation in the next 5 years, but I do not see a good reason why it might not be in 10 years. If you ask kidney transplant surgeons and if you ask people who work in this field, which I did last year when we had an International Pathology Day about transplantation, they're still very much on the side of, let's not pin our hopes on this. Let's look at human kidneys. Let's look at getting better donor programs. Ireland itself has just changed our legislation. So now everybody who doesn't want to donate has to opt out. So we have an automatic opt-in policy now in Ireland, which is really interesting and exciting. So I don't think pin all our hopes, but this is really interesting. It's the first time a clinical trial has been approved for pig organs. And hopefully these people will have good outcomes and it might be another route in the future. I would imagine only for people who are very difficult to transplant, but we don't know. Who knows what 20 years down the line holds?
Ethically, running a trial like this, Lara, these must be people who do not have any other option. Is that correct? And if so, are we trialing what could be a potentially very exciting intervention with people who are almost too far gone to test this properly? Do you know what I mean?
And you're so right. So like I said, there have been about 5 or 6 transplantations of different organs from pigs, and everybody bar this one lady from Alabama have died. And even though you think of them as heroes and their success stories, these people have passed away. So it is very difficult to know what the outcomes would have been. But the essential part of a clinical trial is to do a phase 1, and that is often in people who are very unwell. And it is I suppose, to demonstrate that you are causing no harm by doing this kidney transplantation. And that is a first stage of all medical trials. And I think it's important. But this one lady who, like I said, is from Alabama, but she's in New York currently, is doing really well, like really well. And she was very sick. She's actually, she donated one of her kidneys in her youth to her mother who was unwell. And then her one remaining kidney failed. So it's fantastic. It's very much a good news story. And she's doing amazingly well. So, you know, there is hope. So yes, it can be difficult, but it is an essential part of medical trials, I believe.
Yeah. And just to finish up on that, the thing about this particular intervention, unlike other, you know, the terminal illnesses, with a kidney, it's a single problem that's solved by the replacement of the kidney, right? It's not a systemic disease. If you replace that kidney, that person can be healthy again without other interventions, as long as that hasn't, gotten to real end of life. Is that right?
Yeah, like any doctor, my caveat is going to be yes, but no, but. But like, obviously, the reason that somebody has kidney disease doesn't have to be a completely kidney-specific reason. But yes, there are episodes where people have a failing kidney and it's an acute failure and it's the kidney only and systemically they're really well. And a new kidney, in theory, yes, can swoop in and save the day. Absolutely, that happens.
This is a slightly quicker story, but an interesting one. It's about phosphageddon. What on earth is that?
So phosphageddon is about the looming shortage that the earth is facing of phosphorus. And phosphorus is a key ingredient in chemical fertilizers. So all around the globe, it's used to make sure that plants can, their early development, so for plants to establish strong roots and for seed and flower formation. So across the world, phosphate is added into farmland, but it is mined from rocks and there is a finite amount of it on Earth. And what some people are predicting is that over the next couple of decades, we're going to reach peak phosphorus or peak phosphate mining. And after that, it's going to be much more difficult for us to extract phosphorus. So that's one problem that we have with phosphorus. But the other problem that we have is that when it runs off into water, it produces algal blooms because that's what it does. It's really good at helping things to grow. But of course, what we get is algal blooms in the water, eutrophication, where there isn't enough oxygen in the water for things to live. So it's a big, big pollution problem as well. So those are kind of the two big problems with phosphorus. And the news this week is about an award, an innovation award, the UK Women in Innovation, that was given to a British scientist called Jane Pearce for a really exciting innovation that she's come up with to deal with these two problems with phosphates. And her company, which is called Rockwood Operations, has come up with a novel material, which we don't know much about because it's called PRM, or phosphate removal material. And what it does, it acts like a sponge. So it gets put into water that is heavily polluted, and it is able to suck up all of the phosphates out of the water. And once it's been sucked up, that phosphate can be brought back to the land, where it can essentially be squeezed out like a sponge onto the soil where it's needed for farming. So the idea is this can have a dual benefit. It is helping to deal with, it creates sort of a circular use of phosphates. They can be used in the soil. If they run off into the water, they can be taken out of the water and put back in the soil.
That is great news, and be interesting to hear more about the mechanics of that, but I suppose that's not for today. Our third story, Lara, has to do with our ears.
It does. This is a story that came out of Saarland University in Germany, and it's just a cute and quick little story. And like any good story, it starts with imagining a puppy. So if you will, you're sitting there, you've got your puppy, he's absolutely adorable, and you shout walkies. And what does he do? But he pricks up his ears. And it's very interesting because the muscles for pricking up your ears that cats and horses and dogs have, we have, but it was essentially believed that we didn't use them. Bar those few people who can kind of wiggle their ears, but there's no real functional benefit to that. And this new research, where they looked at 20 different people and they connected electrodes to these muscles, shows that actually we kind of do prick up these muscles when we're trying to actively listen. So what they did was they started to play a podcast to these 20 people. It was a very interesting podcast with a female voice. And then they started to slightly confuse the auditory inputs that they were getting, or the noises that they were getting, by playing other podcasts in the background. So some with a very, very different voice. So it didn't take much to know that it was different, or some with a very similar and quite quiet voice that you really have to try and listen for. And what they found was this muscle that rotates the ears in animals and that we thought was non-functional actually did have electrical activity. Now, I suppose if you were going to play devil's advocate, you could say that maybe these are actually just the electrical inputs that louder noise might create in this muscle. But also it could be a way of seeing whether or not someone is actively listening, something that could potentially be used maybe for hearing aids in the future to try and make them more person specific. So it's quite an interesting little finding.
So is this some sort of evidence to suggest that our ancestors would have had directional ears?
Yeah, so we know that a few million years ago, we lost the ability. So when apes diverged from monkeys, we lost the ability to direct our ears. And so apes can't direct our ears and we can't direct our ears. But evolutionarily and historically, our ancestors could, but we have lost that ability. We kept the muscle, but we lost the ability. A bit like our vestigial appendix that doesn't really do anything but make us sick.
Our final story, Ruth, is an interesting one. It's to do with rats.
Yeah, you often hear that when you're in a big city somewhere, you're no more than a couple of meters from a rat. But this research tells you that's getting truer and truer with time. And that's because of climate change. What else? It's research that came out in Science Advances from the University of Richmond in Virginia. And what the researchers did was they analyzed data from 16 different cities, looking back around 17 years to look at the number of rat sightings and instances and times when pest control have been called out to deal with rat infestations. And what they are seeing is a big increase in the number of rats that are in cities correlated with the increase in temperature in those cities. And I think particularly winter temperatures, because what they say is kind of cold winters are sort of like birth control for rats because, you know, small rat pups don't survive so well in very cold snaps. So that will be act as a control on the population. But as winters are getting milder and milder now, that's not happening. So we're seeing a lot more rats. And these were not small increases. So 70% of the cities that they looked at had significant increases. And these were up to like 390% increase in Washington, D.C.
Oh, my God.
Nearly 200% increase in Toronto, where they are now calling this a perfect rat storm. They are finding it harder and harder to deal with rats in Toronto. I think one of the only cities where they didn't see an increase was Tokyo. And again, they put that down to kind of very high levels of hygiene in the street. That's just happening all the time. But this is a big issue because rats cause billions of dollars in damage to infrastructures in cities. They get into buildings. They can spread diseases. They can damage cables. They, of course, damage the ecology of other urban species when they get in and take over. So, yeah, this is something we need to start thinking about.
Yeah, something to think about, folks. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. Lara Dungan, thank you so much. Now, if you were walking around a cocktail party and asked a particular gentleman what they did for a living, and they replied, "I make toxic semen," you'd want to know more, right? Well, I'm not sure it's the opening gambit for when Maciek Maselko is out on town, but I'm hoping it's within the first 3 minutes he gets that out, because this is a fascinating bit of research. He is an associate professor in applied biosciences at Macquarie University in Sydney. Welcome to the program, Maciek. Tell me a little bit about your research into the insect genome. Maybe Mike, tell us a little bit about your interest and in why you're researching this.
Yeah, so I'm a molecular biologist. So I grew up in the, originally I'm from Poland, grew up in the US, came down to Australia just over 6 years ago with the goal of establishing a research group that uses something we call synthetic biology to genetically engineer animals for a variety of benefits to human and environmental health.
And the animals in question that you're interested in are insects.
Yeah, well, you know, insects, we've got a lot of beneficial insects out there, honeybees and other types of pollinators, but there's also a number of pests out there, most notably mosquitoes, where there's a few species out there that are responsible for a substantial amount of human suffering. And we're looking to develop new and improved methods of getting rid of the pests without having negative impacts on the beneficial species. And the project we have now that was recently published, we developed a method where we are looking at how we can engineer the males, and in the case of mosquitoes, they don't bite, engineer the males so that their seminal fluid is toxic to the females. So then when they mate, those females die.
Which it sounds like something from a horror movie in a way, or a science fiction film, the beginning of one, lots of questions. So the first question is, do we not need mosquitoes for anything, or have we finally come to a point where we feel like they don't serve any particularly important ecological niche that we can do something like this that may end up wiping out mosquitoes in a particular area?
Well, there aren't really many people saying that we should get rid of all mosquitoes, and this wouldn't do that either. And something that's important to keep in mind is that there are over 3,000 species of mosquitoes out there, and only a handful of them are responsible for the vast majority of human suffering. And so what we're looking at doing is really having a targeted approach. Like the mosquitoes that we're especially interested in are Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, which spread Zika, dengue, yellow fever, and they're invasive outside of sub-Saharan Africa. So if we were to be able to get rid of them especially outside of that range, there's probably not going to be any real harm to that.
Right. Okay. Because they weren't supposed to be there in the first place. So it's just sort of winding back a bad ecological step. Talk to us then about the way you go about making toxic semen for mosquitoes. What exactly is the approach? Is this something that you do in the DNA and that's passed down from? I guess it can be passed down, right? So how does this work?
Yeah, so it's definitely a bit of a tricky system for us to try to explore. But the basic idea is that it's already known from other people that males pass on a number of different proteins in their seminal fluid to females and insects, and that those proteins, some of them pass from the female reproductive tract into the female's, basically into the female blood, and can manipulate the female's physiology. So it can do things like make the female less likely to remate, make the trigger ovulation, things like that. And so we thought, can we introduce other proteins into that mix that can then, kill off the female? And we tried a few different approaches, but the one that worked was when we started looking at venom peptides. And so we know that venom peptides are very small. So we reasoned that they could pass through the female reproductive tract into the female bloodstream. And then the real trick was, how do we get them to just be produced in the male reproductive tract, which isn't quite as permeable, not as leaky. So we reasoned it would stay in the male reproductive tract, but then be able to escape from the female reproductive tract into the bloodstream. Yeah, so for that, I know there's a bit here, right? So for that, we had to basically have two strains of mosquitoes that were genetically engineered in a way that one of the strains had the information to make the kind of the sequence information for the venom, and then the other strain had information that would say where to make the venom. So independently, neither strain was able to make the venom, but when we crossed them, those male offspring made the venom just in the reproductive tract, and then we could cross them, make them to females to see if it worked.
That's insane. It seems like a very complicated way of solving this problem. But before we go into that, where did you get the venom from? Which animal does this venom come from?
So we tried a handful of different organisms, and the two that ended up working, one of them was from a type of spider, and another one was from a sea anemone. And I think something that's really important for people to know is that venoms are usually a mixture of different compounds. Many of those compounds are proteins. Some of those have broad effects on maybe like many different species, and some of them are very, very narrowly acting. And the peptides, the proteins that we chose, are the ones that only interact with, which only have targets that are present within invertebrates, so it would pose no threat to, say, humans or mammals or birds.
Okay, so you extract the DNA of this sea anemone, and then splice it with the male mosquito, or just walk me through that process.
Right. It's a bit confusing. So people that sequence genomes and study venoms have figured out what DNA present in spiders or sea anemone or anything else encodes for that venom protein. The problem with that is there's with a gene, a gene doesn't just encode the information of a protein. There's a lot of other associated information for like where and when and how much of it to make. And we needed to tell it to, you know, make it in this particular place in an insect. And so what we needed to actually do is essentially synthesize a custom piece of DNA that brought together these different genetic elements that say make this venom protein only within the reproductive tract of a male fruit fly, which is where we were testing this idea out. And then what we needed to do is we needed to take this DNA and then basically incorporate it into the genome of these male fruit flies, where it could be passed down from generation to generation. And of course, as I mentioned before, we needed initially at least this split system so that, you know, obviously they weren't killing off all the females every time they made it.
That's, I mean, has that been done before where people have taken two different functional genes and created a sort of a hybrid gene that does the two functions to get what you're looking for? Is that a common approach?
Yeah. And so, I mean, even if we think about, you know, like the first example of synthetic biology I mentioned where people were getting microbes to make insulin, it was a similar thing, right? So insulin isn't something that microbes normally make. So they had to take not only the information for just, you know, the region that says this is the insulin protein, they then had to also splice it together with these other components that hold a microbe to make it and to make a lot of it so that it could then be purified into, you know, therapeutic.
Wow. So this venom, then is made in the testes of the mosquitoes, or how does it get into the reproductive tract? And then how does this work for the next generation? Because presumably this will never lead to a conception of more baby mosquitoes,
right?
Or mosquito eggs, How does this take off? I mean, you can't genetically modify every mosquito out there.
Right. So for your first question, we didn't engineer them to make it in the testes. We engineered them to make them in something called an accessory gland. And that's similar, analogous to a prostate gland in humans. And so the prostate gland is responsible for, you know, basically adding fluid into the semen. And so insects have something similar. And so now, when we're moving into mosquitoes and we're working with mosquitoes in the lab right now, what we're doing is we're changing the system a little bit. And now, because we used these fruit flies to identify which venom peptides are gonna work in the system, because not all of them did work, we tested 7 and 2 of them worked. So now that we have these 2 that we wanna move forward with, the next thing we're going to do is we're gonna make a new type of DNA molecule. And this one will allow us to, it gives us an off switch. And the way this off switch works is in the laboratory, when we're going to be rearing these transgenic mosquitoes, we can add a compound to their diet that turns this off so they can mate and reproduce in the lab normally. But then when we release the males into the wild, that compound is gone. And so they'll be producing this venom peptide.
Oh my God, that's insane. How do you come up with that approach? Because it sounds so complicated, clever, but complicated. I'm wondering, how did you end up coming up with this plan? Because the many steps from finding the right venom to figuring out how to put it and how to get the flies to make it, and then how to suppress that so you can get the population to a big enough size to be able to release that into the wild. Did that approach come bit by bit, or was it a master plan?
No. So it definitely came bit by bit. And so really what's amazing about synthetic biology and kind of molecular biology in general is the way in which you can combine bits and pieces of DNA, kind of like modules. And so a lot of these modules already existed out there. And there have been other people in the world that have been developing different types of genetic engineering approaches for controlling mosquitoes. And so they've invented some of these other modules, which are useful for us. And so we kind of combine these different modules together in order to make this system. So the contribution that we have really is, you know, identifying these venom proteins and finding a way to get these modules together so that they work well, because there's certainly a bit of fine tuning together. It's not exactly plug and play, but that's where we come in. But there's a whole field of synthetic biology that, you know, over the last 30 years or so has really been accelerating very rapidly. So there's increasingly sophisticated systems that we're able to make like this one.
So what is the plan then? Have we seen this sort of approach or something similar being successful in compressing the growth of dangerous insects or invasive species?
Yeah, so there's a handful of different technologies out there, and there's a company called Oxitec out of England, where they have a couple of different approaches for controlling mosquitoes. One of them is sort of similar in the sense that in the lab they give these they have these engineered mosquitoes where they can give them this compound that keeps all of the transgenes turned off. Then they only release the males, and then those males pass on a gene that in the wild kills off all of their offspring. So those females have no offspring at all. And then they have another version right now where it's only the females die, so the gene can persist for a few more generations. But I think if you really want to think about what was kind of the origin of all these ideas is there's something called the sterile insect technique. Now, is that something that you're familiar with?
No.
Right. So the sterile insect technique is something that came out around, I think, the 1950s or so. And there was this awful insect in the U.S. in the Americas called the New World Screwworm. And it's this bug where it lays eggs into like the wounds of cattle and sheep. And then the maggots, they'll, you know, create these awful images. If you want real nightmare fuel, then, you know, on Google, do a Google image search on New World Screwworm, and what you'll see is absolutely horrifying.
And Screwworm, yeah, okay.
Yeah, specifically New World Screwworm. There's an Old World Screwworm, it's similar, but yeah, New World Screwworm, that's the real nightmare fuel. And so what people came up with was this idea of, what if we were to use radiation to sterilize insects and then release them into the wild? And the reason that this would work to suppress a population is because for many insects, the females only mate once in their lifetime. They have a little organ where they can store the sperm and then just use that for every time they want to lay eggs. And so if a female mates with a sterile male, then she'll have no offspring. And so what people have done is they had these mass rearing facilities where they were just rearing up all these screwworms. They would sterilize them with radiation, and then they would drop millions upon millions of them from airplanes and slowly push the screwworm out of the kind of southwestern US down to Central America. And then now there's this kind of barrier in Panama where they're producing, there's facilities producing hundreds of millions of these screwworms every week and then releasing them for population suppression. And that idea has caught on and is used for a number of other pests, such as Mediterranean fruit fly, Queensland fruit fly, and a number of others. And so that idea was incredibly successful, but difficult to implement for some species where the dose of radiation necessary to sterilize them was toxic, or you really needed to have a way to separate the males from the females, as is the case with mosquitoes. And so these genetic technologies came along and are essentially finding ways to come up with a better sterile insect technique.
You know, releasing, radioactive insects, the idea of genetically altering mosquitoes to have toxic semen. What are the dangers of these sort of things? Because obviously to the untrained ear, they sound like things could go wrong, but what are the dangers of your particular technique?
Yeah, so one thing I want to go back to really quick, though, to clarify is that the insects that were released after they were sterilized with radiation, they're not radioactive.
I was being facetious, but okay. I was science fictioning it. What are the consequences of interfering with you know, with the genes of mosquitoes, knowing that mutations do happen, you know, from generation to a generation, are there risks with your approach?
Well, the main risk that we're usually worried about is much more from like a technological perspective, in the sense that those mutations would just inactivate the gene. And so then you just have something that simply doesn't work. From kind of an environmental perspective, you know, really what we're looking at is having something that's far more targeted than using chemical pesticides, right? So the, you know, people are like, well, you know, what'll happen when you get rid of that mosquito? It's like, well, right now we're already trying to get rid of that mosquito. Plus we're, you know, causing a whole lot of collateral damage. But if you're talking about the specific risk of our technology compared to maybe some of these other competing technologies is, you know, we are making a venom protein in the seminal fluid, and we selected venom proteins that aren't going to pose any kind of risk to, like, you know, birds or humans or anything like that. But we do know that there are beneficial species out there, like dragonflies, say, beneficial insect species or invertebrates like dragonflies and spiders that will be eating them. And we need to make sure that they're not affected negatively by that. And there's a couple of things that we've done to try to ensure that they'll be okay. One of those is the venom proteins that we've selected. They're ones that have, that are far, far less toxic when consumed orally than, you know, say injected into the bloodstream. So it's unlikely that something's going to be able to consume enough of that to be negatively impacted, especially considering that these males are barely making enough to kill off, say, one female mosquito or something like, or one female fly. That being said, that's the type of experiment that we're going to need to do in the lab and then also in field trials to verify that, you know, these other insects aren't impacted. Otherwise, we're sort of back to the drawing board where it's kind of like a pesticide where you kill what you want to kill, but you're also killing the good guys.
It's absolutely fascinating research. Associate Professor in Applied Biosciences at Macquarie University in Sydney, Maciek Maselko, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Love to know what you made of that piece on toxic semen and mosquitoes. It's funny how life brings you to interesting places, isn't it? Okay, it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week. We were talking about mega icebergs with Geraint Tarling. Did you hear this piece? It's like a 100-mile-wide iceberg, basically calves off the Arctic Circle and then just floats out into the water. And it takes about 3 months and it's gone. Terrifying stuff in a way. Brendan says, I wonder if Jonathan might be interested in learning about a seabed surveying technique called sediment profile imaging, or SPI. They basically have this lander with two cameras. It takes an image of the seabed and then it sort of sinks underneath and then it images there. I'm not entirely sure. You haven't told me why. You give me a lot of details to how this camera works, Brendan, but you haven't really told me why. What can it tell us about seabed conditions and why would I want to know that? If you tell me that, then I can tell you if I'm interested. Joe says, Future Proof, thanks for the most fascinating shows. And that's in capitals. So you're very welcome, Joe. And I hope the capitals indicate your enthusiasm. We had this really interesting piece with Andrew Daly, who is working on essentially building bits of heart that you can sort of glue on to a broken heart, literally like a non-functioning heart where there's been some heart damage. And using stem cells and a bit of goo, you can sort of stick it on and they sort of map together and the stem cells differentiate into heart cells and they start twitching. And it's incredible. If you didn't hear it, it's available on the News Talk player. Sarah says, I have stored my cord blood stem cells. So at first I thought Sarah was saying she'd stored her own, which I thought that would be... I suppose that in fairness, Marais, your cord blood cells, it's your cord. I mean, if you're having a baby, the cord is both yours and your child's. Because I was thinking it's the child's umbilical cord, but I suppose it's also your umbilical cord. Anyway, Sarah says, I have stored my cord blood stem cells. My boy provided more than my girl, 4 and 6 million respectively. That's kind of, I'm not even going to speculate as to why they might. That's just probably just chance. Anyway, Sarah says, can my own cells be utilized to make me my new beta cells within my pancreas? Are the cord blood stem cells not the stem cells of the children? That's what my thought. Like, here's how little I know to be able to answer your question, Sarah. I thought the stem cells in cord blood were from the children and not your own stem cells. That would make sense to me, but maybe your own stem cells are there as well. If they're your own stem cells, I would imagine they can be differentiated into anything, knowing as little as I do about stem cells, but I think that was the whole point of stem cells, they can differentiate in anything. How you might get them to turn into pancreas cells, I don't know. It's not always as simple as take the stem cells and just inject it in the pancreas and there you go. But two questions there. One, are they your stem cells in the cord blood? And two, how do you actually differentiate them into pancreas cells? Two answers I do not have, I'm afraid. But we might ask Andrew Daly and see if he knows. That's it on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Gori Galvin and Hugo De Silva on sound. Thank to you as well for listening. It's very kind of you. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.